It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, April 27th, 2024, I'm Alex Hogan. In the war in Gaza, how do you fight Hamas while preventing the deaths of civilians?
It's probably the worst situation for any assault force to go into. You never want to have to fight in cities because of the collateral damage you can engage in, and it's going to happen.
I'm Jared Halpern. Congress comes to the aid of Ukraine, signaling a truce on a critical call to action by President Biden.
We don't walk away from our allies. We stand with them. We don't let tyrants win. We oppose them. We don't merely watch global events unfold. We shape them.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Major demonstrations are underway at colleges across the country with students protesting the war in Gaza. But it's not just in the U.S. Similar demonstrations are playing out at universities in the U.K., in France, and Australia, too, with students demanding an end to the war. But at the same time, Jewish students on those campuses say that they do not feel safe. Back in Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke out this past weekend about the perspective of the Israeli Defense Forces on the ground.
As our soldiers are united to protect us on the battlefield, we are united to protect them on the political field.
With international pressure for a ceasefire as soon as possible, Egypt sent a delegation to Israel on Friday. And looking forward, the White House says that it still stands by a two-state solution.
We support a two-state solution. You've heard the president talk about that a lot. But it's got to be done through direct negotiations between the parties.
It's been more than 6 months since the October 7th attacks, when hostages were taken by Hamas into Gaza. And recent negotiations to try to secure their release have largely stalled. Families of those hostages tell me that it is agonizing, waiting, wondering if they'll ever come home.
The Israelis are holding off a little bit because of the hostages. When we were over there recently, it's clearly they're concerned about them.
General Keith Kellogg is a retired 3-star Army lieutenant general and a Fox News contributor.
I don't see really they're going to get any resolution with the hostages because I think I'm not sure Hamas even knows where they're all at. The International Red Cross has not been allowed to see him or talk to him. There are still American hostages there. So I think what the Israelis are going to have to do, they're going to have to go in and basically finish the job. They're going to have to go into Rafah. There are still at least 4 Nakba battalions, their active military battalions of Hamas are there. The Hamas leadership is there. It's probably where the remaining hostages are. And I think they're going to have to finish the job and complete it out there and eliminate Hamas as a leadership organization, and then deal with the results with the Palestinians in Gaza after that. It's still, even though that's where they have to go militarily, over the long term, this is going to be an economic, diplomatic issue that's going to take a long time to resolve. And honestly, I don't think you're heading for a two-state solution in the near term. I think a two-state solution now is a pipe dream. I don't think it's going to happen in the near term. Remember, it took us 12 years to reintegrate the South back into the North after our civil war, and I think you're going to look at something very, very similar happening in Israel.
Well, the Israeli military for months now has looked at entering Rafah, which, just to remind our listeners, this is one of the southernmost cities in Gaza. It's near the Rafah crossing in Egypt, but getting aid in has been really difficult and people are not allowed to leave. And Rafah is where most of the population has been sheltering. So let's discuss the level of complexity of what a ground incursion could mean, aerial strikes, and the impact that could have.
Yeah, Alex, and I will tell you, being a former military guy, it's probably the worst situation for any assault force to go into. You never want to have to fight in cities because of the collateral damage you're going to engage in, and it's going to happen. So when they go into the city with the civilian population, first I tell everybody, steel yourself, because I think you're going to see some collateral damage, which is unfortunate, but that's what happens. That's why most military guys don't want to get into wars. When they do, they never want to get into a city fight. So in the complexity of the operation, you're looking at tunnels, you're looking floor to floor, door to door type of fighting by there, and they're going to be very, very precision targeting. They're going to have to go after leadership. That means the intelligence is going to have to be very, very, very key. And then use the precision weapons to the best you got. That's one of the on the support packages that we just have provided the Israelis on precision munitions going in there and eradicating the assault forces. So frankly, it's not going to be a pretty fight. It never is. There's going to be casualties on both sides. There's going to be civilian casualties. I think you're going to have to just accept that, whether you like it or not. That's the way it is. And then you're just going to go and finish it. And I think that's one of the reasons why they've been hesitant to go in there, because they know what's happened. It's a last fight for them. And Hamas realizes that, too. I mean, they're not up in Gaza City now. They're right on the border, like you mentioned, at Rafah. And it's going to be a fight to the finish. But the Israelis have got to do it. They've got to clean out this cancer. And if they don't do it, it's just going to repeat itself into the future. So it's going to be a tough, close-in, hand-to-hand, face-to-face kind of fight.
Well, because of some of the challenges that you mentioned, the White House has warned the Israeli government not to enter Rafah because, again, as you said, the risk of killing civilians is just too high. Do you think that the Israeli government is listening to Washington?
Well, they're listening to them. I mean, they're hearing what they're saying, but they're going to ignore them, and they should. I mean, this was a fight between good and evil. These Israelis didn't start this fight. Hamas is a terrorist organization. When it is Israel, they raped, looted, pillaged, burned, and killed civilians and Americans, and took Americans hostage as well. So they're not the good guys in this. And I think where the administration makes a huge mistake, Alex, is they try to run a middle ground on it. They try to moderate it. And it's not a moderation issue. It's really between good and evil. And they need that with Hamas. And they need to understand that. And yet they create a seam or a gap between us and the Israelis by saying things like that. This is one of those times when you're in the national security team and you're in the White House Situation Room, you take a very deep breath, you steel yourself, and you look at the Israelis and say, we've got your back, you've got to go in, you've got to finish the job, you've got to reduce, eliminate, eradicate Hamas and their leadership as well. And that's one of those things you have to just acknowledge. That's in the Middle East. Is it pretty? No, it's not. But it's a fact of life, and you have to do it. That's why, again, when you fight wars like this, they're not, you know, these people are not Jeffersonian Democrats, and it's not going to be a nice fight. But that's the way it is, and you have to accept it.
Well, at the same time, let's look at the issue and the complexity and the trauma that is playing out in the Gaza Strip. So health officials in Gaza, they say that 34,000 people have died since the start of the war on October 7th, and that two-thirds of them were women and children. So there's no way to verify these numbers. They've not been confirmed internationally, but there hasn't really been any dispute of these numbers that we're seeing. And because of that, there's been a lot of pressure from governments around the world demanding that there are better precautions from the Israeli government to protect civilians. So I've gone into Gaza. I was in central Gaza outside of Khan Yunis, and I did not see one building that had not been destroyed or riddled with bullet holes. So given the speed of the destruction, the dismantling of these tunnels and what that means and the number of dead, how do we conduct an operation in general while also trying to protect civilian life?
Well, Alex, this is where I said you have to steel yourself and you have to back away from it. You know, once you understand, you have to understand and accept the fact that when you get into city fighting, collateral damage, that means civilians are going to lose their lives. That happens. Historically, in the United States, we've done it also. You know, when you look at the Civil War, when Sherman went to Atlanta, he burned the city to the ground. In World War II, we firebombed Dresden for no reason except to send a message and killed hundreds and hundreds and thousands of civilians as well. This is a fight to the finish, okay? And I look at the Israelis and say, look, nobody said it was going to be pretty. Nobody said it was going to be nice, but it's war. And that is why when war and all its brutality, why the military is horrific about it. They don't want to go there. But now that they're there, they've got to finish the job. And I would tell people who say you go in there and say, look, this is why when it happens, you never want to get to a point you're at, but you've got to let them finish the job, because what's happening, if you don't, you're going to have this cancer come back again and again and again. And the other, you know, I think what's going to have to happen is this thing will only stop when Palestinians start loving their children more than they're hating the Israelis. And they understand that fight's going to occur. And that's, Alex, it's not a pretty sight. It's hard. It's horrific. I've got it. But this is a fight. And they're going to have to allow themselves, allow the Israelis to go in there and finish the job. I mean, there are plenty of nations that are out there that make those comments, but they don't have to understand the underlying symptoms to what's happening. We said in 1945, Alex, never again would we tolerate what we saw in 1945. And the Trump administration followed through on that. That's the reason we went into Syria after they used nerve gas on their civilians. They crossed a line we were not going to accept. And Hamas has crossed a line with the Israelis when they attacked the kibbutz, and they also attacked the festival site. So again, it's one of those, you got to be hard. Well, it's hardcore, but that's the way it is.
Let's talk about what we're seeing along the strip. So we've talked about the South and Rafah and the potential there moving forward of what this could mean. Let's talk about the North. So the IDF has been hitting northern Israel in recent, or has been hitting northern Gaza in recent days, which is notable because the IDF months ago said that it had secured the North. So is this surprising to you that we are still seeing some of these cells of Hamas fighters popping up in northern Gaza?
No, it doesn't, Alex, because you're never going to eradicate every last terrorist in an organization. That's never going to happen. That's the reason why when I talked to Gallant there in Tel Aviv, they were going pretty heavy after the leadership. You've got to eradicate the leadership and keep going after the leadership, because you're never going to get rid of everybody. But I think what they're doing is reaching out and touching, kind of keep them off balance, off guard. And that's what you see. It's not the same that you're going to see in the South, but it's the way of doing it. It's sort of the same thing with the far north of Israel with the Hezbollah, you've got that back and forth with Hezbollah, and with no major ground operations or missiles coming from Hezbollah or major ground operations from the Israelis. It's kind of a tit for tat. It's just them keeping off balance. It's a military tactic. It's tactical and it's operational for the Israelis to do it. It doesn't surprise me. I'm not surprised at all that they're hitting them like that. It'll continue.
Now, one other aspect of this war, of course, is the global impact and the regional conflict. So there's been a tremendous effort to prevent the conflict from spilling out into surrounding regions, but there have been more than 130 attacks from the Houthis on U.S. Navy ships and commercial vessels since November. So we're seeing a broader uptick now in the attacks from the Houthis on U.S. bases. So what's the level of concern on that issue and their ability to defend themselves?
Well, my level of concern, if you're going to get a regional war breakout, it's going to break out in the Middle East much faster. It's going to break out in the European plains between Ukraine and Russia, mm-hmm. primarily because the possibility of a mistake is very, very large there. Example, you know, with the Houthis shooting surface-to-ship missiles into the Red Sea area, you know, and the USS Gravely was nearly hit by one about 2 months ago. They had to use their close-in defense system called the Phalanx system to defeat it. But could you imagine if a missile hit one of our capital ships, Navy ships, and sunk it, or some pretty damaged with 300 sailors on board? You're going to start a major fight between us and Iran, because that's who's supplying the missiles. The Houthis mm-hmm. are not getting these missiles from the local Toys R Us. They're getting from Iran. And that's the reason why the administration is very, very firm with Iran. That's the reason I think if anybody established deterrence recently, it was the Israelis when they went right at Iran after Iran went right at Israel. And I think that sets a standard that we need to follow, that we, the United States, need to follow. It's really an acceptable for the Houthis to do that. A lot of global commerce is going around South Africa. They're not going, you know, through the Red Sea. And you see a lot of major commercial carriers just diverting traffic, which is causing an economic issue. And we're allowing the Houthis to do that. We're just kind of accepting it. And you can't accept that. You have to be very hard, and you go back to the source. And the source is Iran. That's who's providing them training. That's who's providing them munitions, and probably to a large degree, guidance as well.
Yeah, well, speaking about that, as it pertains to Iran, the recent interference by Iran, do you see that as just being a distraction for Israel, another front that they're having to fight on top of everything that we're seeing, and also the latest sanctions that the U.S., U.K., and Canada imposed this week targeting individuals and companies who are involved in Iran's drone production? Do you think that that will make an impact?
Well, I think what the Israelis did is they said deterrence is broken. The United States has not established deterrence in the Middle East region. So what the Israelis said, well, if you're not going to do it, we're going to do it. And that's the reason why, for the first time, you saw the Iranians shoot missiles into Israel, and the Israelis fired back pretty hard. And the reason I say a level of deterrence has been established was the targeting that interested me the most. So what happened is the Iranians shot at Nevatim Air Base, which is near Dimona, which is the nuclear site of the Israelis, crown jewel. And the Israelis responded by going after Isfahan, which is near the Natanz nuclear facility. And both of them said, we can reach out and touch your crown jewels, which is your nuclear programs, the emerging one of Iran and the one that the Israelis have. And I think everybody kind of took a deep breath and took a step back. That's the reason the level of deterrence was established, not by the United States, but I think by the Israelis, when they basically said, we're going to come after you if we have to, we're going to go, to use a military term, we're going to come downtown and visit you with your target, with your sites, of your nuclear sites, instead of just military sites or commercial sites, we're going to go after the crown jewel, which is your emergent nuclear program, and we can go after it. I think that's critical. I think, so that's where they really went to. And I think that is critical. And the Israelis set that condition. And what happened? The Iranians backed off a lot. And then you kind of said, okay, we're done. And I think they understood the message that the Israelis sent to them.
Now, one other topic I want to get your insight on is this pier that the U.S. is building that's trying to provide more relief to civilians in Gaza. This should be finished in the next month. But given all of the security concerns you just mentioned, there are real security concerns for U.S. forces, including that mortar attack in the last week. So what are the calculations that you think need to be made to make sure that those American troops that are this close in proximity to a war, remain safe overseas?
Yeah, Alex, I think it's messaging. I think we have to send a very clear message. We have not. And we need to do that. If Americans are harmed in any way, then we're going to hold the government's power responsible, be the Iran, let's say Iranians. You know, this is what President Donald J. Trump said in his last State of the Union address. If you harm an American, your life is forfeit. He said that. So just go pull it up. It's right there in public on his last State of the Union address. And I think he needs to reinforce that. That's what we need to tell everybody. Don't mess with the Americans. They're bringing humanitarian aid in. And if you attack Americans, it's attack on America proper, and we'll respond accordingly. And then we follow through, because you can have all the kit, the equipment that you want to have in the Middle East. If you haven't got the will to use it, then it means really nothing. But we need to have the equipment there and then the will to use it. And if you harm an American, we're going to go to the source.
General Keith Kellogg, thank you so much for all of your expertise and, of course, your time.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Congress delivered. After several months of starts and stops, the House and Senate gave final approval to a $95 billion international aid package, providing critical weapons to Ukraine, Israel, and partners in the Indo-Pacific.
At the end of the day, most of us, whether we're Democrats, Republicans, or Independents, believe that America must stand up for what is right. We don't walk away from our allies. We stand with them. We don't let tyrants win. We oppose them. We don't merely watch global events unfold, we shape them. That's what it means to be the indispensable nation. That's what it means to be the world's superpower and the world's leading democracy.
President Biden thanked congressional leaders, including House Speaker Mike Johnson, who for months held off on a Ukraine funding bill that did not include immigration and border enforcement sought by many in his party. And that decision could come at a cost to his speakership, amid threats to call a vote to vacate the chair. After last weekend's vote, the speaker brushed aside those worries.
As I've said many times, I don't walk around this building being worried about a motion to vacate. I have to do my job. We did. I've done here what I believe to be the right thing, and that is to allow the House to work its will. And as I've said, you do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may.
The breakthrough in an overwhelming bipartisan vote followed months and months of partisan gridlock over Ukraine, Israel, the border, and overall spending. And at times, it appeared any new Ukraine aid from the U.S. was dead. So what brought the measure back to life? Fox News senior congressional correspondent Chad Pergram says it's simple: events.
Well, it's funny how the package started. If you go back to the fall, actually really go back to the summer, where there was a push to get Ukraine more funding. And then October 7th happened, and that seemed to change everything on Capitol Hill. And you had Republicans in the Senate who said, oh, we are reluctant to fund Ukraine, but we'll do it if you do border security. And in fact, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, he was, game to do it that way. Well, everything then changed. There was a point earlier this year when the triumvirate of Kyrsten Sinema, Chris Murphy, and James Lankford were trying to put their border bill together, and Mitch McConnell had this very frank conversation with his members and said the politics of this have changed. And then all of a sudden, you had 2 months in change of working on border security, and then that fell by the wayside. So what were they back to doing? Well, money for Ukraine, money for Israel. This was amped up post October 7th, and money for Taiwan. Well, the reason they weren't able to do it right away were a couple of factors. Number one, they didn't have the votes, certainly not in the House of Representatives, to get it out of the Rules Committee. Had the votes on the floor, supermajority. Didn't have the will at that first moment of the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson. And they were dealing with a couple of other crises. We flirted with multiple government shutdowns. So they kind of had to get over that hurdle first. And once they did, it was very interesting if you listen closely to the language of Mike Johnson just a couple of weeks ago, where he said, you know, we'll get through this and then we'll move on to the next thing. And he had intimated, but not said directly, they would deal with foreign aid. There was some talk they could go around him, some parliamentary procedures of something called defeating the previous question. I won't bore you with the details right now. A discharge petition, something that's only been effective twice in the past quarter century, where you go over the head of the speaker. But what happened at the end of the day is that Mike Johnson was influenced by this pressure to get something done for Ukraine. But really, the events of just a couple of weeks ago where Iran struck Israel, the fact that Iran struck Israel, I always talk about Harold Macmillan, the British Prime Minister, who said the most important factor in politics are events. So we had an event. Iran tried to strike Israel. And as a result, that intensified the conversation on Capitol Hill about trying to get aid to Israel, but also then Ukraine. And so that's when things started to come together. And that's how they got this across the finish line, putting this on the floor with supermajorities. All three bills scored more than 300 votes. That's remarkable in the House, and 79 votes, a big bipartisan vote, in the Senate.
But the Speaker still had to go around the right flank of his conference.
Yes, he did.
And not just the right flank. I mean, especially the Ukraine portion, there were an awful lot of Republicans who voted against that. You know, I was struck by, you know, over the weekend, what Mike Johnson talked about, kind of looking at this through the lens of kind of history and kind of this American role. That isn't really the way he'd been talking about this issue in the months and weeks prior, was it?
No, and certainly not if you go back further with his speakership. You know, some of this is the education of Mike Johnson. Some of this is also being the Speaker of the House and realizing that you have to do more things than just for your district in Louisiana. Or as the vice chair of the conference, you are now in leadership and you have to make different types of decisions and different types of calculations, especially when you are the Speaker of the House and you have more than 300 votes in the body for these bills. Okay, you're right. He has to be wary of his right flank and Marjorie Taylor Greene. And this is where I have drawn allusions to, you heard of Boris Johnson, who was the Prime Minister in the United Kingdom. Well, we have another prime minister here. We have Prime Minister Johnson in the United States. He is basically the prime minister of the House of Representatives, or Commons, as you might call it here, because he has a coalition government going. You know, we have these coalition governments put together a lot of times in Europe where you don't have a clear winner between the different political parties, and they pluck off a few people from all the parties, and that's the coalition. So that's essentially what we have going on here, that he plucked off a lot of Democrats. He certainly had a lot of Republicans for some of these plans as well, certainly more so for Israel, although I should note that, you know, some conservatives didn't want to help Israel out because this is unpaid for money and things,
right.
You know, so they weren't willing to go there. Taiwan, kind of the same argument. So this was the education of Mike Johnson, the evolution of Mike Johnson, starting to get security briefings, intelligence briefings at the very top levels, talking to the president, talking to Mitch McConnell. I was struck by the fact that Mitch McConnell, who's not going to be the Republican leader anymore later this year after the election, this is probably his valedictory in terms of legislation.
He put the blame for it on former President Trump.
Some of it, yes, indeed. But that was something with Mitch McConnell where he you know, push this almost harder than Chuck Schumer did, frankly.
Yeah.
And certainly some of the Democrats, because, you know, he is an old foreign policy hand on this. He had worked with President Biden when they were both in the Senate on foreign policy issues. And that's how they got that done. Now, here's going to be the problem. It took him 9-10 months almost to get this done. This will not be the last time that Israel comes with hat in hand to Washington, D.C., based on what's going on there right now. Mm-hmm. This will certainly not be the last time that Kyiv comes to Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. with hat in hand. What does that look like? There was a very compelling, very academic speech, an argument laid out by J.D. Vance, the Republican senator from Ohio, opposing the aid to Ukraine, and saying that some of these Neville Chamberlain moments, you know, dating back to World War II, those arguments weren't accurate. And he made a pretty compelling case for that. He said, you know, we've always been told, he said he was, you know, graduating from high school in 2003, living on McKinley Street in Middletown, Ohio, and signing up for the military because we were going into Iraq, and that was the threat. And as everybody knows, 21 years later, that yes, we invaded Iraq. There weren't weapons of mass destruction there, but that was what everybody was ginned up about. And what Vance was essentially getting at is that sometimes the government doesn't tell you the truth. And so that's why he was looking at this with a very jaundiced eye as to what Ukraine really needs, what's really needed if they were to succeed against Russia. Not saying that he was defending Russia by any stretch of the imagination, but just kind of an alternative viewpoint on this. And I was also struck by, if you look at the vote in February, when they passed a pretty familiar-looking package back in February to what the Senate did just the past couple of days here for Israel, Taiwan, and Ukraine, you didn't have a majority of Senate Republicans voting yes. There were 26 Republicans who voted no. You had 22 who voted yes, so not even a majority of that conference. Those numbers changed. They changed where they got 30 Republicans to vote yes. People like Katie Britt, Lindsey Graham, who kind of had been on the fence for a couple of different reasons, came around to this. You know, that was notable, that was a big change. And I had pressed, you know, some Republican senators as to what was the change. And I think that they saw, you know, the desperation by Ukraine, the fact that they coupled all these bills together, including TikTok, that kind of sweetened the pot, and also the needs of Israel because of what happened just a couple of weeks ago.
Let me ask about Marjorie Taylor Greene, because you mentioned her, and obviously she has indicated that, you know, Ukraine aid, I don't know if she's used the term red line, but that seems to, you know, listening to her being her red line on what would trigger her to make this motion to vacate a live motion. She did not do that before the House broke. And I'm curious from your reporting, because, you know, when I covered the Hill, and you may have taught me this saying, when you have the votes, you vote. There was nothing procedurally that stopped her from calling this right away after that Ukraine vote. So I'm curious, was that an indication that she does not believe she has the votes?
Yeah. If you have the votes, you push the issue. And she does not have the votes. What she's trying to do right now is kind of whip up support, maybe have a tidal wave of people who are back in their districts saying, you know, I can't believe you supported that Mike Johnson on that bill, or I can't believe that you're standing by and letting him, I know you voted no, but why are you letting him still be Speaker of the House, that type of thing. They want that to kind of gin up organically back in the districts. We'll see if that's successful. It's Tim Burchett, the Republican from Tennessee, who said sometimes a timeout makes things kind of simmer down. Sometimes it gins it up more. We'll see which way it goes when they come back to session. But two or three times now, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene said that weeks ago, that Ukraine was kind of her red line, saying I will try to kick him out if he puts a Ukraine bill on the floor. Then after they did the government funding bill, she was apoplectic and then introduced her resolution but did not trigger it. I interviewed her a couple of weeks ago and I said, well, what is, you know, what are you looking for? What's the signal? What's the signpost? And she couldn't really say. And I said, do you know in your mind? And she couldn't really say. So this is kind of an amorphous suggestion here by Marjorie Taylor Greene as to what they are really, what her MO really is here. You know, had she put the bill on the floor or put the resolution on the floor to remove Mike Johnson, she would have lost. and Mike Johnson would have survived and gotten stronger. I will say this, Jared, there was not a vote of no confidence. Back to our parliamentary system here. There was not a vote of no confidence in the House of Commons here on Capitol Hill in Mike Johnson's leadership per se, like Marjorie Taylor Greene was trying to do, a motion to vacate. But in fact, there was. The vote on Ukraine was the vote of confidence. The fact that he put that on the floor, and Democrats and Republicans, albeit many more Democrats than members of the GOP, supported that particular bill, and he survived. Mike Johnson might not have a lot of power, but he has just enough. That was the vote of confidence, and he's here to stay for the time being.
He also has another big thing going for him that his predecessor, Kevin McCarthy, did not have, and that is the support of former President Trump. I remember covering the run-up to the vote to oust McCarthy, and we were all kind of wondering, like, is Trump going to send a signal to, save him? And it never came. Trump has given that signal, at least for now, to Mike Johnson.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, kind of suggested to Marjorie Taylor Greene to kind of back off a little bit. You know, I will say that there are some Republicans who also just never want to go through what they went through in the fall. They might not be pleased with Mike Johnson, but they are very upset with how things have gone. But they're like, you know what? I mean, you talked to Bob Good, who's the chairman of the Freedom Caucus, who said, you know, we went through a pretty rough process. They burned through three other speaker candidates and, you know, it took them, 3 weeks to land on Mike Johnson. And when they finally got there, as Bob Good said, he said, you know, we picked the wrong candidate. I don't know who that magic person is on a white horse who they can get at this point. And if you think it took three weeks back then, well, how long would it take now?
Picked the wrong candidate. I mean, he was like the fifth or sixth candidate to emerge.
You see, and therein lies the problem, is that everybody's like, you know, they want the perfect person, but they can't tell you who that perfect person is. And if you have somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene, well, why doesn't she run for speaker? Why doesn't Chip Roy? These are people who are always critical of how things are going, but they haven't been willing to dip their toe in the water. So until you have, you know, as I always say, you can't beat somebody with nobody. They have nobody right now. No, and I mean nobody. I mean, there is not a good bench right now. Jared, my wife calls me Dr. Doom at home. you want me to give you a doomsday house scenario?
Let's do it.
All right. Regardless of who wins the presidency, let's get to the start of the new Congress. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, because it's a very close House, we don't know which party is going to win the House this fall. All right? Mm-hmm. So let's say we finally determine that it is, in fact, the Republicans, that they hold control right now. They do that on January 3rd. The new Congress is to meet at noon on January 3rd. The first order of business after a quorum call is that you absolutely have to elect a speaker. What if they get into a problem like they did last time around, trying to elect a speaker? Remember, it took 5 days to elect Kevin McCarthy in January of last year. Here's the doomsday part. Under statute, they have to certify the Electoral College for President of the United States starting on January 6th. You can't start to do that until you have an operational House and have a Speaker of the House.
Wow. So they would be unable to certify the election.
You got it. There's a reason why they call me back at home Darth Pergrim.
Well, that, I mean, listen, but you speak to a real, scenario, right? This is not like fantasy fiction. This is something, to your point, that we have seen play out to a lesser degree, and the environment's not going to shift dramatically just because there's an election in November, will it?
Yep, you got it. You got it. So I don't sleep a lot at night, Jared.
Well, hopefully you get some sleep this weekend. It was a long week for you. But, let me just finish with this because I did want to get into. So as Congress sort of comes back now, the government's funded through September. The Ukraine bill is taken care of. Is there a lot else? I mean, folks are running for re-election. You've got the conventions this summer. What do we expect out of Congress between now and the end of the year?
Well, the first thing I would look at are Republicans in the House making a lot of political hay about these protests at the at Columbia,
at the schools,
Yale,
at Columbia,
and every place
Yale, Berkeley, yeah.
Control of the House to a degree runs through New York State. And that's why these vulnerable Republicans who won control of the House are there, and the Speaker of the House going to speak at Columbia. Mike Lawler, not too far from New York City. You had Anthony D'Esposito. You've had Ray LaLotta. You know, you get the idea. These guys going and talking about this. And heretofore, silence from the two Democratic leaders who happen to be New Yorkers, Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, even a demonstration outside a Seder at Chuck Schumer's house the other day, in fact.
Right.
You know, so they don't quite know what to do with this. So already you had Republicans in the House. They were, you know, taking this to the bank with these hearings with the folks from the other Ivy League schools, Elise Stefanik, also from New York State, pushing this. That's significant. And it also shows a schism on the Democratic side over Israel and the Palestinians and who's really, you know, the progressives and the more, quote, mainstream side. Does that affect the turnout supporting Biden this fall? That is a problem for Democrats. So that's the next thing to watch. But in terms of things they absolutely have to do, Jared, fund the government on September 30th. So a new Appropriations Committee chairman, Tom Cole of Oklahoma, I should point out that here we are late April, and we still don't have a top line spending number for these spending bills. And it's getting a little late in the game. There was a Dr. Seuss book, and I don't remember which book it was, but the quote is, "How did it get so late so early?" And so here we are. It's getting late very early here, Jared. We're already worried about September because that's the next thing they have to do. And so guess what? That's a problem. It's almost May, but they don't have a spending line, a top line funding number, and that could cause a problem with them trying to fund the government in the fall. And I want to see what that looks like after the various gymnastics we've been through the past couple of weeks here on the Hill.
Well, and it's also not going to be a hyper-partisan environment 6 weeks before the election.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Everybody's going to be calm and very respectful of each other. Yes.
All right. Well, we will look forward to all of that in the weeks and months ahead. As always, Chad Pergram, appreciate the time.
I will keep you apprised of various disturbances in the force.
Thank you so much, Chad.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, the Supreme Court is considering new protections of presidential power. Hearing arguments to an immunity claim by former President Trump. We'll recap a heated question and answer session by the justices and detail the options that could redefine the office of the presidency. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Democrat turned independent challenger to President Biden, has both major presidential campaigns worried. What are his strengths and weaknesses in his underdog White House bid? Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Jared Halpern. This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.